Mr. Schmidt, it appears you're connected, but I don't see your face. I wonder if your camera is off. Now I can see you. All right. Well, the court was in recess. The court is now back in session. I apologize for the delay. We're about 5 minutes late. The panel was conferring on another matter on a different Zoom channel, and but I apologize for the delay. We are now ready for the oral arguments in the final case set for oral argument today, and that's case number A20-0954, in re the matter of the welfare of HB. Counsel, I believe, are familiar with our protocols. If you choose the proper setting for view, you will always be able to see the time clock. Both of you, of course, will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and appellant's counsel will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for the appellant, you may identify yourself and then begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel, John Schmidt, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney on behalf of the state of Minnesota. The state is asking this court to take a hard look at this case and correct the legal errors that the district court made. Once corrected, the court should then weigh the six factors and give greater weight to factors 1 and 3. When both of those things are done, it becomes clear that despite the abuse of discretion standard, this court should reverse because certification was necessary to protect public safety. I recognize that as the appellant, the abuse of discretion standard is a high hurdle, but this is the rare case where discretion was abused and reversal is required. The court abused its discretion by mixing up the factors, going beyond the plain statutory language, clearly erring in some factual findings, and failing to give due deference to the two most important factors.
Could I just confirm, this would have been a presumptive certification if it had happened 10 days later?
Am correct.
I correct? All right.
Yes. The age difference between the juvenile at issue in this case compared to his co-defendant was just a few weeks apart, and his co-defendant was presumptively certified and pled guilty and was sentenced in adult court.
Mr. Schmidt, can I, just based on your introduction, you broke down the issue in two ways, or one and two. One, this court that should review an error that should be corrected. And then number two, then analyze the six factors and give greater weight to 1 and 3. I'm a little unsure what you mean by that, in the sense that we know the district court, in fact, gave verbalized in the order greater weight to 1 and 3 and did analyze all six factors. So what separately from simply reviewing the record and using our abusive standard was the error that you mean in part one, separate from the factors?
Error,
if I misunderstand, you can correct me. Thank you.
No, Judge, that's right. The error was committed in the analyzing of the factors. And so the legal error, and in particular in the culpability factor, the court there erred as a matter of law by going beyond the plain statutory language.
Is there any case law support for what the court did?
No, not in terms of culpability. There is no case law support. I'm sorry, go ahead, Judge.
Is there any case law either way? I mean, supporting what the judge did or supporting your position?
The case law supporting my position is based on the plain statutory language and the cases analyzing the plain statutory language, which is the culpability in committing the alleged offenses. And the language is particular that it's about the child's participation in planning and carrying out the offense and the existence of any mitigating factors recognized by the sentencing guidelines. That is the end of the analysis. And the district court here said that HB was fully culpable. The court further found that there was no mitigating factors recognized by the sentencing guidelines.
Well, aren't mitigating factors something we consider in sentencing? I mean, wouldn't this be an appropriate thing to talk about in sentencing?
It certainly could be something that can be talked about in sentencing. And the factor, the cases that the district court cited, Roper, Graham, and Miller, are all punishment cases. They all go to the punishment of the juvenile at issue in that case. But the statutory language is clear that it's about mitigating factors as recognized by the sentencing guidelines. Those mitigating factors include things like, was the victim the aggressor? Did the offender play a minor role in the crime? Had the offender had some sort of physical or mental impairment? None of those exist in this case, and the district court specifically found there were no sentencing guideline mitigating factors. So it erred as a matter of law in going beyond the plain language of the statute in addressing things like the juvenile academic research, scientific studies about the juvenile mind, none of which were specific to this particular juvenile.
Mr. Schmidt, might it be possible, even if the court didn't articulate the sentencing guideline, you just referenced mental impairment. The evidence, as I understand it, does indicate an opinion of a diagnosis of PTSD and then other factors related to that. As part of our review, could we not look at that? And even though the court didn't call it mental impairment, the records support a conclusion there was mental impairment, which then fits the lack of culpability conclusion the court arrived at on that factor?
Well, certainly you have to take away the academic and scientific and case law that the district court relied upon that has nothing to do with HB. At a very minimum, the district court erred in considering those factors. When it looks to the diagnosis, that is something that's considered elsewhere in the factors. That's something that the other factors would take that in consideration. And the district court here erred by using the diagnosis as throughout the analysis to explain away the various factors. And that was an error and an abuse of discretion. The plain language of this particular factor is extremely specific. And the district court found that there are no sentencing guideline mitigation factors. And so it erred as a matter of law and going beyond that. The court correctly determined that the seriousness of the crime and the prior record of delinquency weighed heavily and strongly supported certification. But beyond erring as a matter of law on number two, the district court abused its discretion and clearly erred regarding the programming history related to HB. The programming history looks at HB's past willingness to participate meaningfully in available programming, and also, as this court has held, looks at demonstrated behavioral changes correlated with the programming. Now, the court overemphasized one particular programming at bar none over the history of programming that HB showed that he's not willingly participating in. And even in that one instance, the court ignored the fact that HB told the judge he was going to go back and continue programming at bar none, but then he immediately fled. In fact, fled after leaving court. After those programming, there were no positive behavioral changes correlated with any of the programming.
So are you claiming that that fact is clearly erroneous?
I'm claiming that giving bar none, saying that was a positive programming, was clearly erroneous, given everything that happened immediately after, that he fled bar none, that after bar none, his behavior didn't change. And in fact, he committed two carjackings and murdered Steve Markey in broad daylight on a busy street. And so, yes, that is a clearly erroneous fact. And at a minimum, the court abused its discretion in overemphasizing this one potentially positive programming over the long history of failed programming, including what happened after this programming. So factor four should have weighed in favor of certification. Factor five, the court erred as a matter of law in overlooking the punishment. Now, the court, the factor five considers both the adequacy of the punishment and the programming available. An analysis of the district court's order, the court basically, the court said at one point in time that the punishment available in juvenile court is woefully inadequate to punish for these crimes. But then in its conclusion, the court ignored that and said the adequacy of punishment or programming available does not weigh in favor of certifying these matters for adult prosecution. The court basically threw out punishment and only looked at the programming available. That was an abuse of discretion. That's an error as a matter of law. It's both. And it's true, as the court found, the punishment is woefully inadequate to punish for the murder of Steve Markey, for the carjacking of two other victims, all of which were at gunpoint. And notably, even after these crimes, HB was found with another gun. And so it shows that his behavior is increasingly violent and escalating criminal behavior. The dispositional options available, we think, as I've argued in the briefs, should have weighed in favor of certification, or at a minimum, slightly favored retaining it in EJJ.
Well, how do you respond to the argument, though, of the respondent here, that because of the particular problems that this juvenile has, and because of the need that these particular problems be addressed, and the inability to get those specific problems addressed in prison, that keeping the child in the juvenile system where programs are available in the long run will be more beneficial to the public safety than just sending this kid to prison?
Well, I completely disagree with that, and for a couple of reasons. One, the length of time available in the juvenile court is 2 years. Now, even as the experts concluded, the experts that the district court relied upon, Dr. Rankin said that HB is at a high risk for future violence, including serious violence. Now, they certainly outlined treatment that's available in the juvenile system, and that treatment might benefit HB. But like in other cases from this court, that's putting the speculative treatment ahead of public safety. There's no way to know that 2 years is going to be sufficiently adequate. But we certainly know that based on the prior history of programming and how that history has resulted in the lack of behavioral changes, that it is speculative to say that he's going to be fully rehabilitated in 2 years, such that public safety will be protected.
Do you have, were there experts that opined on that point?
No, the experts that that opined on this, I mean, Dr. Rankin did say that he is at a high risk of future violence. The probation officer talked about what treatment is available in the adult system. And Dr. Rankin's report talks about the fact that although the juvenile system provides one specific area where all this can be done together, the adult system does have these things available, although it may not be all in one place. But the rehabilitation, to say that 2 years is sufficient time for the intensive treatment that is necessary, overlooks the fact that he has never willingly participated in rehabilitation, and that the one slightly positive programming that the district court recognized, he fled from immediately after court and then committed three extremely serious crimes. One of which was shooting in the middle of the day in broad daylight with lots of other people around. It's fortunate that nobody else was struck by the bullets that he and his co-defendant were firing at this car as they tried to drive away.
Mr. Schmidt, can I ask you perhaps an overall question, given the a great deference that we are to give to the district court? And I'm assuming you agree, I believe it was in PCT and other cases, that the fact that factors 1 and 3 may favor certification does not mean non-certification is inappropriate. And then adding to that, this the burden in this non-presumptive case to the state must prove by clear and convincing evidence. What is your main bullet point in looking at these factors, or which one or ones that tells us there's an abuse of discretion? It's kind of maybe going back to your intro, but I want to, are you able to coalesce it into a kind of a big picture answer?
Yes. We're not advocating for a rule of law that says when factors 1 and 3 favor certification that you must certify. That is not what we're advocating for here. What we're saying is that the district court abused her discretion when analyzing these factors, and particularly committed a legal error in factor 2 and going beyond the plain statutory language and considering things that should have been considered in other factors, and further erred in factor 4. So when summing it all up together and properly weighed, factors 1, 2, 3, and 4 all heavily favor certification. Certainly 1 and 3 strongly favor certification. The district court got that right. Factors 5 and 6 would slightly favor certification or slightly favor retaining an EJJ. When properly weighed, the clear and convincing evidence shows that the juvenile court and retaining jurisdiction in juvenile court does not serve public safety, and we ask that this court reverse.
I have one question which has to do with the dispositional options. Is that if I'm looking at the dates and doing the calculations in my head, I believe that when the district court issued its order, HB had just turned 17. So it seems like there were potentially at that point in time 4 years available before his 21st birthday.
That's correct.
Okay. And the experts testified that, in their view, 2 or 3 years of rehabilitation would be necessary or appropriate?
Would be necessary. At a minimum, they testified, it was a minimum of 2 to 3 years.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, please identify yourself, and then you may begin. I think you're muted, Mr. Nyvold.
There we go. Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor. Mark Nyvold, representing respondent HB. Mr. Schmidt covered quite a bit of ground, and I addressed all his points in my brief. So I'd like to just make clear that if I don't get to one of his points, it is addressed in my brief. But so let me take kind of address this overarching argument, one of seems to be that the court abused its discretion because, you know, HB would flee from these placements and treatment settings. And that he even did that after what I think even the state would acknowledge was a favorable evaluation and set the stage for a recommendation that he get treatment as part of this disposition. The problem, you know, he left because he thought that the 45 days of bar none, he could leave. But even if that hadn't been the case, the problem here in just about every instance in which he's been placed somewhere is he has PTSD, which has never been diagnosed. And the experts testified, you know, that this is his response fleeing. It's not that he's obstreperous or resistant to treatment. He's had a trauma-filled childhood, and he was never properly diagnosed. It was conduct disorder, which doesn't, you know, recognize all the aspects of PTSD. And it's this PTSD reactive flight response. He doesn't have the ability to think things through. He just reacts.
Well, it's a result of trauma. Mr. Nyvold, I'm just thinking about your arguments and and the court's consideration of those arguments. And I can tell you, when I was a district court judge for almost a decade, there's very few reports that I got back on juveniles that said they came from a great family and they were nurtured by their parents. They all had terrible, terrible family backgrounds. I mean, it was almost all of them. So I guess if this were a consideration that we're to make whenever we're deciding culpability, why hasn't that ever been required in any case, or why hasn't it been done by any court that I'm aware of, other than this one?
Your Honor, I recognize that it's not very productive or helpful or persuasive to say he had a terrible childhood and therefore the court did not abuse its discretion. My point is that his specific deficits were directly responsible for all this behavior that looks like he can't and won't accept treatment.
I mean,
he's got a behavior now that is ingrained where he'll flee from places. That's what needs to be treated. It's never been diagnosed. PTSD has never been properly diagnosed, never been treated.
But if he's fleeing, I mean, wouldn't the confinement of a prison be, or something where there's a greater deal of confinement, be more appropriate for him? Otherwise, we're just setting him up to fail, aren't we?
Yes, Dr. Rinken and Dr. Garrity testified that he needs to be placed in a secure setting, but that does not have to be an adult prison. It should be a setting like Red Wing, where he can both be in a secure setting to counteract this tendency to flee until he can get that under control, that can be adequately treated, and he can get the appropriate treatment. The court knew what it was looking at and decided that because he'd never been properly treated, and the experts confirmed that, never properly diagnosed with PTSD, that if he can get the appropriate trauma-informed treatment and at Red Wing, which is available, that makes it reasonable to give him an EJJ disposition and see, let that treatment, which has never been administered to him, take hold. If he he's got an adult sentence that he'll have to serve.
I assume right now you're referring to the factor number 4. And my question is, if you simply look at that factor and the our case law, PCT in particular, in which programming, unsuccessful program seems to be a key piece of evidence here that the court ignored, isn't it true that that factor does not ask why one did not successfully complete treatment, but that treatment has not been successful? And that's the point the appellant's making, that the court made a factually, clearly erroneous factual finding. I believe you're still muted.
You're still muted. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I think the court recognized that we don't have a system in which we just have to take this automatic or kind of robotic approach to resolving how juveniles should be treated or punished and punished. There's nothing in the case law that says the court cannot ask or take into account why these behaviors occurred. And if the court correctly or with evidentiary support concludes that this child's behaviors were for reasons that were involved inadequate treatment, that providing that treatment serves public safety. That's the basis for the court's ruling, that there is a way to curtail and get HB the treatment he needs so that he's not doing these antisocial behaviors. He's not continually fleeing. I mean, it looks bad on the surface, I admit, you know, he's just continually leaving. But if you look at what the court heard and that there is treatment that Dr. Rinken recommended he receive, that Dr. Garrity recommended he receive, despite the risk, the public safety risk that has existed up until this point, that court had a evidentiary foundation to rely on that.
Mr. Nabel, can I maybe take you to factor number two? And part of the point made by appellant is, number one, the court relied on evidence that doesn't rely. In other words, now we're getting back to the experts who specifically, as I understand it, did not consider public safety in their recommendation, but simply what treatments needed. Now, as to factor number two, the culpability, isn't it true, or how do you respond to the point? It seems that the plain language of that requirement, the culpability and the sentencing guidelines, would you agree the court went beyond those two constraints by that rule in determining he's not culpable after saying that he was culpable?
You're muted again. Mr. Nyvold, you're muted.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It seems to be muting itself. I don't know why it continually does that. But
we won't accuse Mr. Schmidt on the record of having anything to do with that.
Right. Your Honor, in the ACL decision, which I cited in my brief, the word including in these various factors, which is also in the culpability factor, signals that the court need not consider only those factors that are listed. Certainly, the sentencing guidelines are there to be considered, but the court isn't limited to that. The court can consider things like culpability, brain research into juveniles, and it doesn't have to be specific. It's not that HB has to go and get an evaluation and find out, should we, consider that there are, your brain is adequately or sufficiently traumatized that should be taken into account. This is applicable information that this court can consider under
ACL.
Can
I just clarify, though, the point I understand appellant making is the factual error and perhaps the abuse of discretion is that's the wrong factor. That might apply to factors 5 and 6, programming history, what diagnoses there are or not. But isn't factor number two simply states whether he was culpable and then references sentencing guidelines? And the court had answered that before getting into case law about juvenile brain development.
Well, there's no case that says that brain research cannot be considered. Culpability for sentencing, for example, in Roper and Graham, in those cases, it was the sentence that was at issue. But culpability is culpability. It in terms of a juvenile disposition, considering culpability, the court can take into account factors that, like brain science and research into juvenile brains. There's no case that says the court can't do that, and that's perfectly appropriate. It's not simply a sentencing based. The brain research isn't limited to decisions the court makes at sentencing. It certainly has to apply here. Culpability is at issue.
If that so-called brain research from Roper and Graham, if that were a relevant factor here, wouldn't that be a relevant factor in every juvenile certification case? I mean, as I understand the research, it's just simply about the age of the brain. And so if juvenile certification is always about whether a 15, 16, or 17-year-old, for example, should be certified as an adult, then, then that research would, if it comes in here, it seems like it comes in every case, and basically, I'm just wondering if that's what the legislature had in mind.
Well, there's nothing in the statute that precludes it, and if it's relevant, why shouldn't it be concluded? I don't think it's some sort of unfair advantage or results is in any sense improper or unfair to the system or to victims or anyone else, that what is an obvious fact, which is that juvenile brains are different from adult brains, has to be taken into account. I think courts do that anyway. Courts know they're dealing with juveniles. That's why we have a juvenile system. That's why we don't treat them as adults while they're children.
Let me go back to your statement that there's nothing in the statute that precludes it. I think that's what you said. I mean, I think I disagree. As I read the second factor in the clause that begins including, refers to two things. It includes level of the child's participation in planning and carrying out. And the second thing is the existence of any mitigating factors. But that second thing is limited by what follows, recognized by the sentencing guidelines. I mean, doesn't that basically mean that it does not include mitigating factors that are not recognized by the sentencing guidelines?
No, I think they're talking there about mitigating factors that the sentencing guidelines recognize. They're not saying that's the only thing you can consider. And
why wouldn't the statute just say including the first thing and any mitigating factors stop? I mean, the fact that the statute didn't stop, it said essentially so long as those mitigating factors are recognized by the sentencing guidelines.
Well,
that's the way I'm reading the statute.
Okay, but it certainly doesn't say that only mitigating factors in the sentencing guidelines can be considered. And the ACL decision makes clear that the court need not consider only those factors that are listed. The word including does not mean that's all you can consider. This court has already
decided that. I understand that's the way including usually is understood. And I understand this is not crystal clear. It's not explicit, but it's a matter of statutory interpretation, I think, that Mr. Schmidt has raised. Let me ask you this hypothetical. Let's say you're invited to a party and you're invited to bring anything you want, including any crackers, cheese, or non-alcoholic beverages. So nobody said you can't bring alcoholic beverages, but wouldn't you think that's implied by the fact that beverages is modified by non-alcoholic?
Well, again, that ignores that there's case law that has already said that the word including does not preclude the consideration of other factors. Okay, this court in the ACL decision has already recognized that.
Maybe
so
I should ask
that's a different context, Your Honor. You're right. A different context.
It's a hypothetical, understood. Yeah. Is there any case law about the factor two? Is there any case law in which the appellate courts have permitted the consideration of mitigating factors that are not recognized by the sentencing guidelines?
Well, I think I've just answered. If
case law, I mean case law arising from juvenile certification.
Well, that is, well, ACL is a juvenile case.
Okay, and what was the mitigating factor in ACL?
Well, they just in discussing actually the culpability factor, as stated above, the word including signals that the court need not consider only those factors that are listed. Okay, so there's press or authority for what the court did, and if I could just make one closing statement, I'm out of time.
Well, I'll make sure you have enough time, but I guess I'm just wondering in the ACL case, what I'm not familiar with it. What was the particular mitigating factor that was at issue there that was offered and considered and did the appellate court approve?
Well, the district court found that the child's youth and impulsivity and the imperfect defense of self and home and extreme remorse lessened his culpability.
But was that a sentencing case?
No, this is a juvenile certification case. And again, it's cited in my brief. And it's at 2007 Westlaw 447080. So
feel free to take your time in closing, Mr.
Okay. You know, the court said it was relying on the burden of proof. And it's important to recognize that unlike PCT, where the state had the burden, then this is a non-presumptive case. Or PCT, the juvenile had the burden. Here, the state had the burden to show by clear and convincing evidence that retaining the case in the juvenile system would not serve public safety. And the court made a very thorough analysis of all the juvenile factors, and it certainly cannot be considered to have understated or minimized any of the risks and the problems here, but recognize that we can do the intelligent thing to protect public safety, which is to get treatment for HB that is available only in the juvenile system, only at Red Wing, the trauma-informed treatment, or we can send him to prison for 20 years, at which point he will be released and pose an even greater risk to the public. I disagree with Mr. Schmidt. He cannot, and the testimony at the hearing confirms this, he cannot get anything approaching the appropriate treatment if he goes to adult prison. He'll just be essentially left to become, his problems become even more deep-seated if that's the case. And the court made a difficult but intelligent and factually and legally supported decision. Thank you.
Mr. Neville, I have one question to follow up on what you just said. You referred to the fact that this was non-presumptive, the state had the burden. I'm wondering, does that affect our standard of review? And if so, is there any case law, appellate authority that says so? Is our standard of review different? Maybe not perhaps a different label, but different by degrees or different in nature, arising from the fact that this was non-presumptive, and so therefore the state had the burden in the district court, as opposed to a case that's presumptive?
Makes it much easier to uphold the district court's decision, because the state had the burden of proof. And this, I realize Mr. Schmidt has argued what he thinks are legal errors, but in my brief, I point out there aren't any errors of law and no clearly erroneous factual determinations. The state has, you know, tried to portray some things in a way that might make it look like, well, okay, the court's abusing its discretion, but the court, if you read its order, recognizes the public safety risk, but takes the expert testimony, Dr. Garrity, Dr. Rankin, and that treatment is although certainly problematic, is the preferred course here. And the court had the discretion to accept that. It's maybe not a decision every judge would make, but if you read the order, it's clear the court very carefully and concisely weighed all the evidence and decided that public safety is best served in the long term by the juvenile EJJ disposition. So I think that it not being a presumptive case means that the court, I think, had, and it was easier, much easier for the court to find that the state had not met its burden. And, you know, again, the court, it's abuse of discretion and clear error of a law of fact, and the court hasn't made any of those. So I think the court has an easier time upholding the court than if it was a presumptive case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nyvold. Mr. Schmidt, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
I'd like to bring this back to the very basics. And the basics are that the touchstone of this analysis is public safety. Dr. Garrity and Dr. Rankin never addressed public safety in their reports. They also never said anything in their reports about culpability. The district court erred in considering their reports in factor two about culpability. It goes beyond what the plain language of the statute articulates for consideration. The statute doesn't say including but not limited to, and the statute says these are the mitigating factors that can be considered, and there are those that are articulated in the sentencing guidelines. That was an error.
Isn't it culpability for the commission relative to the commission of the offense?
It is. I mean, the plain language of the statute says the culpability of the child in committing the alleged offense. And that's it. And the alleged offenses here are holding one person at gunpoint and carjacking her and running over her phone so she can't call the police, carjacking a second person when he's on his way into his apartment, trying to carjack a third person and shooting him and killing him in broad daylight in Northeast Minneapolis. That is the culpability of the offense. And if you look at the complaints, which for purposes of certification must be taken as true, it shows that he also brought a backpack with him and changed his clothes following one of these crimes. That shows foresight. That shows planning and the extreme indifference to human life that occurred by shooting in a busy street cannot be overlooked. And he did fire his gun at this car. So it is, the language is the culpability in committing the alleged offenses.
Like, well, what would give us a right? I mean, let's say we agree with you that the judge's discussion of culpability based on her analysis was legally in error. And we agree with you that she may have been clearly erroneous relative to her finding regarding his prior success in programming. What right do we have as a reviewing court to reweigh these factors?
When you correct those legal errors, then it is up to the court to reweigh the factors and to determine whether when those legal errors are corrected, whether certification is necessary. And this isn't a situation where the district court's factual findings should be given more deference based on the fact that she watched the testimony, because she found every single witness that testified credible. There is no credibility determinations that were made here. Based on that, the level of deference afforded to a district court when no credibility determinations are being made, you can weigh that evidence and reweigh these factors and determine that certification is necessary to protect public safety, because there's simply not enough time left in juvenile proceedings to fully protect public safety. Now, Dr. Garrity and Dr. Rankin's reports are certainly relevant when it comes to other factors, factors 5 and 6, but they're not relevant for culpability. They're not relevant for the programming history and the willingness to participate, especially when the one potentially positive program was 45 days, from which then he fled and committed 3 very serious crimes with a gun. This is like PCT, where the interventions are speculative and they might address the risk of BH engaging in future violence. But when compared to the assured benefit of public safety that accompanies adult prison sentences, certification was necessary and needs to happen in order to protect public safety. We ask that this court reverse.
Schmidt, I have to follow up on Judge Hooten's last question. Is there any case law about the appropriate appellate remedy in the situation she described? And I think the situation she was describing can be stated this way. Let's assume that we agree with you that the district court misanalyzed the second factor and the fourth factor. Is it, why not reverse and remand and ask the district court to reanalyze and reweigh all 6 factors together with that correction in mind, rather than our doing it here at the Court of Appeals?
Is there any
authority, any case law that directs us or guides us in making that decision about the appropriate appellate remedy?
I believe it's in PCT, where the court did reverse and say that you should correct these and then certify. Now maybe I am not remembering that exactly correctly, but that is a reverse and remanded. And it said that...
Question is remand for what, right?
Well, remanded for
for adult proceedings court. or for further consideration of the certification motion.
I believe it was adult.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I think we're thinking the same thing.
Yeah, I believe it was issue. For adult proceedings because the holding, at least on the first page of that, is that it was reversed and the court held that the trial court abused its discretion in failing to give greater weight to the seriousness of those factors. And it remanded, so we reverse, order that respondent be certified to stand trial as an adult and remand for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. So it was remanded. The court in that case, a published case from 2012, said it's reversed, it must be certified, remanded for proceedings in adult court.
And I would imagine this could be case by case. In some cases, the factors might be more closely divided and require reweighing by the district court in the first instance, perhaps. But so in this case, why would we not let the district court, if we were to correct the analysis under the second and fourth factors, why not reverse and remand and ask the district court to reweigh 1 through 4 versus 5 and 6?
Because at that point, like PCT, if you follow the statutory mandate and give greater weight to factors 1 and 3, and correct the legal errors that occurred and the abuses of discretion that occurred in factors 2 and 4. It's clear that the clear and convincing evidence requires certification. And I agree, it wouldn't necessarily, you're not writing a rule of law that says every single case that we would reanalyze, reweigh the factors, or that every single case where factors 1 and 3 strongly favor certification, that certification is required. But in this case, with these 3 very serious crimes, with all using firearms and one resulting in the death of Steve Markey, certification is required.
Would you concede? I mean, I know that you made arguments on the last 2 factors regarding programming, but would you concede that the judge had expert testimony that would support her determination that those factors favored keeping the matter in extended juvenile jurisdiction?
I think in factor 6, that might weigh slightly, and there's certainly a record in factor 6 that would support EJJ. But as I said in the reply brief, factors 5 and 6 may slightly favor that. But factor 5, the court erred in completely ignoring the punishment aspect of factor 5. The court only focused on the potential for programming. The punishment was one sentence said that it is woefully inadequate to punish, and then thrown out and looked completely at the programming available. So I the programming, there's certainly a record that the court had for that. But when looking at the dispositional options available in juvenile or adult, there's certainly good programs in the juvenile system, but there's also very good programs in the adult system. And when weighing that factor, at best, it slightly favors EJJ.
It appears there are no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Thank you to both counsel. The case was very well argued, both in writing and orally. We appreciate the arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion in writing within the time allowed.
Thank you.
That is